I often say that addiction is the result of not knowing how to find safety inside of yourself. So you find it in something else, and understandably, you get hooked on it because you're desperate for safety. That's all you're guilty of. Any of you looking to learn more about supporting addiction recovery through a trauma-informed and somatic lens and a nutritional lens, please join me for my addiction circle. This is a bi-monthly, entirely free virtual circle that I invite anyone here to come and join if they want more information. Addiction tends to be so steeped in shame, and I find that doing this work in a community of people helps to destigmatize that shame so you can see how not alone you are in the experience. So whether you are personally withdrawing, preventing, experiencing relapse, or you work with people who are actively addicted or in recovery, all are welcome.
The next Addiction Circle will be held on Tuesday, May 7th at 5 p.m. EDT. This meeting is not recorded for the sake of anonymity. No registration is necessary. Just join through the link below.
You are listening to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I am your host, Luis Mojica. I'm a holistic therapist, and my goal is to teach people how to find safety in themselves. I use nutrition, herbalism, self-inquiry, and somatic therapy to heal the body and mind of trauma. I have learned that each and every one of us has the ability to heal, to love, and to access all of the answers we're looking for. To do this, we first need to learn how to listen to our bodies and understand our minds. Let us begin. So my guest on today's show is David Berger. He is a somatic psychologist, a physical therapist, and a body worker. In addition to this, he was one of my teachers when I was studying somatic therapy. And one thing I gained from him was the subtle shifts to look for and feel for in the body. He's very good at that detail and resonating with the client in front of him and actually feeling it in his own body through a kind of somatic empathy. So I wanted to have him on the show just to talk about the physiology of trauma. And as you'll hear shortly, we spoke about chronic pain, and we spoke about how chronic pain can even be a threat to the body, rather, I should say, perceived as a threat to the body. And he gives plenty of examples of this. But for all of you listening, one thing he spoke about several times was interrupting. And I found that to be a really important word, because when we have pain, let's say in our knees, let's say your left knee is in a lot of pain, your nature is going to be to constrict around the pain. And then because you're constricting around the pain, your other knee makes up for it. And then your hips, then your lower back, your spine, your shoulders, your jaw, everything starts making up for it. As those different parts of the body make up for it, they are sending these signals to the brain that something's wrong, you know, because the body is getting a bit physically disoriented. And that something's wrong creates more constriction. And this is how chronic pain builds through the years. And what I loved about our talk was there's no real distinction between physical pain, as in shock trauma, like a car accident or getting hit by something physically, and emotional pain. Pain is pain. And what I'm hearing from him is the constriction is what causes more pain, whereas the expansion and the softening is what helps release the stored trauma and helps to start releasing the pain. So the medicine for pain is really mobility and softening, expansion, opening. And if you're in really chronic pain, you have to start really small, tiny, tiny, tiny movements, tiny, tiny, tiny breaths, softening the area maybe for 2 minutes a day. You know, you start somewhere and you work your way up. My favorite part of the interview and my takeaway is when he said, on a relational level, meaning how we connect to humans, human to human, we have this implicit threat response to difference. And that is that's etched into our DNA, that's etched into our cells for survival. You know, a bear has it. A deer has it. A fish has it. It can see that something's different from it, and it assesses if it's a predator or not. And as human beings, we have taken that implicit generational animal instinct of a difference equaling a threat, and we've acted on it. We've created behavior. We've created mass cultural shifts based on those beliefs and behaviors, which come from implicit response. So the primitive response to see a different skin color as a different tribe, to see a different sexual orientation, to see a different genre of music, to see a different sex, a male or female physically, or those of us in between. There are so many communities we call minority communities, LGBTQ communities, the racial minority communities, gender communities, let's say gender fluid people, let's say female bodied people. We've had these different communities over the years try to empower themselves and get equal. And I find it interesting that our culture blossoms from the individual who feels threatened unconsciously by someone or something that's different from it, and then acts on the threat. Acting on the threat could be physical, you know, physically assaulting a person, could be yelling and screaming at someone, which is physical, could be making up beliefs about someone. Either way, we've seen this in our own country, how divided we've become because we act on a threatening belief system. So what David said that I found so beautiful is the real practice to have is to become so embodied that you can feel when that implicit threat is turned on and you can interrupt it, meaning you experience it, and then you kind of gently hush it back to a place of being calm, like you would a child putting them back to bed after a nightmare, so that we don't react, so that we don't create a behavioral response to something implicit. The way I like to put it is our human self, which is really our spirit, our consciousness, our soul, we are inhabiting these earthly animal bodies, and these bodies are programmed for survival. So their job is to keep us alive, to look for threat. What we have to do as humans, the same way we are trying to take care of our planet, we have to take care of our bodies and look out for when our bodies are experiencing threat and help the body understand you're safe. You don't have to react. You don't have to behave in response to this. Let's inquire. And I'll use David's word in this interview. Let's use trauma response as an invitation so that we can really get the gift of trauma and the gift of being embodied. And then we can connect without fear. We can really just connect with love and safety. My guest today is David Berger. He's also one of my teachers, so I'm very honored to have him on. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
And so the first question I ask everybody, and especially you, I'd like to hear how people's journeys brought them to work with trauma specifically. And you started with the body. So I'm just curious if you could tell us how you found your way to mental health and trauma healing.
Sure. I'd be happy to. My initial entry to healing professions is as a physical therapist. So I went to graduate school at Stanford in physical therapy. And it really set a foundation to understand the body vis-a-vis the medical approach to healing, to fixing, to changing how somebody is. And the first, but I was always very interested in what later became titled alternative therapies, body work, complementary therapies, et cetera. And this is some 40 years ago. My first work, professional work, was in major rehab centers. I was working a lot with people with major traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, et cetera. I did a lot of work in pediatrics as well. And after that work, I migrated toward working in pediatrics, acute care here back out in California. I had moved away for the other and also open the doors on studying body work and alternative therapies and all. Studied a number of different kinds of body work, which led my practice to shift to working with people with chronic pain. And after several years of that, decided to go back to school in psychology. So for a second graduate degree in psychology with a specialty in somatic psychology or body-oriented psychotherapy. And during that program, you are learning all the typical material in a graduate program in psych, but then also in the field of somatics or body-oriented psych and the bridging between the two. So really that's what the field of somatics is. And during that program, I learned many, many things, including material about trauma, which was, that was 20 years ago, the work of Peter Levine, who developed somatic experiencing, and realized that all the years prior, I'd been working in this field of trauma, but understanding it from really a structural medical perspective, which is what trauma is in from that model. But trauma as we know it now, and Dr. Levine is a major, major contributor to understanding trauma as a nervous system imbalance or dysregularity. So from that program and from being introduced to him, I steeped myself in the field of trauma as a whole human being, not just the physical structures of the body. Whole human being, emotional, physical, spiritual, psychological, et cetera. And as a nervous system, dysregulation is what we call it. And I've been sort of in that route, on this journey since then, since the early 90s, since the early 80s, really bridging these fields of the body, physical medicine, physical therapies, mental health therapies, but really the not so much how they relate to each other as different entities, but along a continuum. We have to have a continuum of possibilities, entry routes to help people heal from trauma.
And that's why I wanted to speak with you particularly, because I love the holistic viewpoint you take, and you have such a rich background in learning the whole spectrum of it, clinically. And so the first word that called my attention was chronic pain. And I'm curious, the correlation between chronic pain and trauma for you as you were learning and seeing this with your clients?
Yeah. One of the things that happens when someone is physically injured, and so they may go see a physical therapist, a chiropractor, an osteopath, a medical doctor, is that they are they're in pain, and the body's responding. And if they can get fixed quickly with proper treatment, that's great. But if not, then the bracing that accompanies the sensory information from the body saying, wait here. Something's wrong. The body needs time, rest. If that doesn't get respected and approached, treated, let's say, in the proper way, then that hold that is put on us physiologically, functionally, structurally, etc., that hold or bracing pattern is not approached properly, then it can translate through a number of different neurological structures in the body, in the brain, in the spinal cord and the brain, that then affect other structures, that then affect others. And our emotional selves are also involved with this, and it can perpetuate. And over time, as it perpetuates, i.e. becomes chronic, it can involve multiple systems of the body. So it might start out as acute physical pain and or emotional pain that does not get consoled, regulated, treated in the proper way, will keep the system agitated or maybe even a lesser form of agitated, but over time, chronic mild distress, chronic distress, and will eventually affect all systems of the body, or many systems of the body. And then, and that's what we becomes chronic pain, migrates into syndromal patterns, et cetera.
So that's interesting. So that's, and what you're saying there is chronic pain, physical manifest, then how it then leads to emotional issues and issues in the rest of the body. What about the opposite? What about chronic pain as a manifestation of unconscious trauma, unprocessed trauma? What's that like?
Emotional trauma, you mean?
Yes.
Absolutely. In fact, chronic physical pain and emotional pain are integrated or registered in the same place in the brain. So they're really over time, they're both warning signals. Something's not right, either emotionally not right in that category or physically not right in that category. Something's not right and needs attending to. And if it doesn't, if the infant or the young child doesn't get the proper attending to, or the infant or child, or let's say teenager, gets physically injured, doesn't get the proper attending to, then they collide. They collide, they glue onto each other. And they potentiate each other as well in that way. So it can start in either direction, from either direction, let's say. But they are intermingled in many ways.
I like that, because when I hear you say that, I think of, I'm always trying to reframe trauma for people so they can understand that it's almost a gift from the body. Like, traumatized is different, but that trauma response is a gift from the body that says something's not right. So when you're saying to me that whether it's emotional trauma, physical trauma, and there's emotional or physical pain, it's like a temple bell, if you will, that says, I need tending to. And whether it's childhood development and there's neglect or there's abuse, or whether you're an adult and you're overworking, you're pushing through, that's how the neglect begins to form. And then from there, the chronic pain and disease manifests. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. And maybe I'd shift the word gift to the word opportunity. It's an opportunity for a gift, because the gift comes from healing.
I love that. The opportunity
for healing comes from the origination.
That's really nice. That's really nice, because it's more of like invitation, opportunity, and then what you do with it can be really powerful, and either direction can be powerful. Yeah,
exactly.
So right. when people hear us talking about the word trauma, can you explain to us physiologically what happens when you either, whether it's a physical shock trauma, like you're hit or there's a car accident, or there's emotional trauma, or vicarious trauma where you're just watching it, you know, where you have nothing's even happened to you, but you're watching somebody get hurt or you're watching the news. Can you explain to us what happens in the body when there's that sympathetic charge?
Well, with all three of those circumstances, there are slight differences depending on the sensory input, if it's physical or if it's auditory or visual, we're taking it in emotionally. But in essence, what happens is that we have built into us, in our nervous system, the ability to really pay attention, to flee, to fight, to protect ourselves, to protect our young ones, et cetera. And if we can manifest that sufficiently, that's great. And then we have all the survival energy that's built into what's called the sympathetic nervous system. And then, you know, the adrenaline system, let's say. And we know that after a big adrenaline rush, we shake, we discharge, we settle all that out of ourselves. And then we can rest. And the counter to that is the parasympathetic nervous system. Rest and digest, settle, ease up. That actually is a time when the immune system is highly at its height of functioning, when we're really in that deep rest state. And if those are not efficient enough or sufficient enough, or don't have the proper amount of time, by proper I mean physiological time, not clock time, physiological time, then we have other avenues available to us neurologically. We can actually, connecting with another human being, tend and befriend, or social engagement does help us calm as well, and can lead to that. But when not, and we're still with this fear and terror in our system, we begin to shut down. We begin to go to collapse. We begin to go to shut down. We're also hardwired for this as well. And what that does is say, we're putting the brakes on here. We're going to make sure, our nervous system is going to make sure that you as a human being is given, takes enough time to settle, to ease, to move toward the next steps of healing. We're hardwired for that. But if we don't come out of that efficiently, and by efficiently, what I mean is into an environment that supports nurturing, an environment that supports healing, an environment that supports regulation, our ability to, oh, I'm here, I'm alive, I succeeded, I survived. Then we've got this relationship between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic, which is an easing up or a shutting down completely, that doesn't have the nice flow and balance and ease that it should. And over time, that what we call dysregulation, that imbalance, that finely tuned dance between the two becomes mistuned or misattuned and maintains inside of us. Now we can navigate that. You know, some people can navigate it really quite well for a long period of time. Some people, when exposed or living in pervasively traumatizing environments, like in poverty or in environment of colorism or environments included in the military or childhood abuse situations, where that chronic distress pattern that perpetuates that imbalanced dance, let's say, between sympathetic and parasympathetic, well, that over time rises to keep us in that misattuned internal dance and relational dance. And even with the person who's navigated it well enough, has had privilege, has had opportunity, but there's been some distressors along the way, even that person over time may hit, to use the metaphor, a last straw on the camel's back, right? We all have a breaking point. It's a question of what's the container that allows for some flexibility or not moving toward that or a reset, right, before we get to that breaking point.
I'm glad you said that part, because I think a lot of people bypass their need to listen to that. How do I say that? I mean, I'm hearing it just simply as regulation, like when you're talking about the container. They bypass I don't even think they know they have the need, because, let's say, of privilege or because the environment right now is really nice. They think they should be okay. They don't really even think there's something lingering. And this one thing I love about SE so much is when you're sitting in your body in that format, it starts coming and speaking to you in ways you didn't know were there. So when you're not aware, let's say for those listening who are just becoming aware of that they actually hold trauma in their bodies, mm-hmm. What are some of the actual physical symptoms of stored trauma that hasn't regulated yet?
Oh, there could be numerous symptoms. It could be any kind of physical pain syndrome, chronic pain syndrome. It can be emotional dis-ease. It can be repetitive relational dynamics. It can be hypervigilance, kind of always wondering when, not if, when is the next thing going to happen. It could be difficulty sleeping, difficulty eating, eating disorders, so many, many different things that, you know, if a good comparison might be a domesticated animal, a dog, let's say, right, that is a healthy dog. They have cycles, they have rhythms, and they're able to honor, their physiology can honor their physiological rhythms in that way. They sleep as they need, they sleep well, they perk up, they run, they play, they protect, right? And then they sleep again in rhythmic format. Well, human beings should be able to do the same things. In addition to going to work, in addition to this, in addition to that, get antied up, you know, go into arousal, get anxious even, but then come down from it and let it go. or maybe not let it go entirely, but, oh, yes, that still exists and I need to do that. I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm not going to clench my gut. I'm not going to constrict in my jaw. Yes, I need to do that. And tomorrow morning at 9, I will do that. For example.
I have a question about that for you. What's your personal take or philosophy around why, as human beings, like our species so easily traumatized, especially as we've become more civilized out of even more primitive cultures where there was shaking and chanting and such? Is it a socialized issue because we've become more polite? Or I'm curious what your input is around why it's so easy for us to get traumatized versus a wild animal.
Well, that's a very big question. Somewhat perhaps scientific, somewhat perhaps philosophical, but you know, in part it's going to include generations and generations and generations, transgenerational responses to highly overwhelming, activating circumstances. We come in with a makeup that is not like, you know, Freud would talk about a blank slate. We don't come in with a blank slate. We come in with a history, whether it's a history of a pogrom here or a genocide there or slavery or the Holocaust or whatever the history is. We come in and there is epigenetically some sort of programming, let's say, let's just use that word, in addition to learned behaviors in response to our provider environment, our holding environment, that can keep us grounded, consoled, regulate us when we need it until we can become more self-regulated or not. And that includes neurological makeup. The autonomic or non-conscious parts of the nervous system that keep every system in our being functioning.
So, I mean, potentially just hearing you say that, when I hear transgenerational, then to me that makes sense of how a whole culture's trauma, a whole culture had its trauma response to that trauma as well, right? Genetically and through each generation. So that's how our societies are really, and cultures are shaped from those ancient wounds in a way that haven't healed. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And transgenerational and ancient healings as well. Mm-hmm. The thing about trauma response, it speaks loudly. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways it speaks more loudly than the healing responses. Because like physical pain, emotional pain, they call loudly, pay attention to me when I'm doing well. And the healing history, the healing experiences are, you know, there. They don't yell as loudly. They don't speak as loudly. That which, you know, speaks loudly, you know, what is it? The squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? Yeah.
That's a really beautiful way to put it. I know people listening are going to appreciate that because it's really easy. It's not, I've worked with so many people who have lived a lifetime of being in a traumatized body and haven't known it. And so they're so used to the adrenaline, they're so used to the sympathetic charge that their capacity to feel the subtlety of joy or relief, it's so new to them. Mm-hmm. And so they're used to hearing the pain. And this is where my next question comes in. When you're used to hearing the pain, whether it's been decades of hip pain, shoulder pain, GI issues, you know, migraines, whatever it is, trying to make my question simple because I have two. So the first question would be, how does chronic pain re-traumatize or add to trauma as some kind of implicit threat because the body is being attacked, let's say? I'll start with that question.
Okay. Well, chronic pain is an internal threat. It's experienced as an internal threat. And so we're responding not just to the past experiences. We may know some of it consciously, cognitively, but we may not. Maybe more procedural memory, implicit memory, and present time pain, and they intermingle. So it can perpetuate a threat response. And it's going to be an incomplete threat response because the template for moving through the whole physiology of it is, nope, going to get stuck, going to get stuck, going to get stuck. Because if I survive, literally, if I survive, the most primitive parts of our brain say, if I survive, I did something right. If I did something right, I will do it again. So we kind of get stuck in that, right? In SE, in somatic experiencing, our job is to help interrupt in a very, very small way, a very manageable way, that repetitive cycle. And it's got to be really small, because too much change at one time, even toward feeling good, can be interpreted bottom up, a physiological interpretation, a non-conscious interpretation, a change that is threatening. Right? So where are we going to go with that, right? We're going to go right back, re-traumatize. So it's so important that it's done incrementally.
Now, how does that relate to, this was part two of that question, how does it relate to coping with pain, whether it be medicines, numbing agents, eating, drinking alcohol, watching TV, dissociating? I'm just curious how the coping mechanisms of the pain, how does that relate to that interruption? Because that's not really interrupting, that's freezing around it or distracting from it. I'm curious physiologically. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking toward if we're talking about the goal is toward a release of the constriction when you're in the sympathetic charge, how do coping mechanisms and medications and pain relievers get in the way and or help?
Yeah. Well, acutely, I'll talk about myself for a moment. I had a total hip replacement 1 week ago. I was just coming out of the operating room about 1 week ago. Okay. And I am very glad to have had pain medication. Okay? The propofol for the anesthesia, the spinal, the local morphine afterwards. So it lasted quite some time. And more noxious sensations, stimuli. We don't have pain receptors in our body. We have sensory receptors that respond to noxious stimuli that are then interpreted in the spinal cord and in the brain as pain. Very important distinction. And so I had pain medications. And when I went home that day, I was monitoring, I was feeling, and I've watched it, I have felt it, I have tracked it shift day by day by day, and really spent some time softening, easing. I've not needed, some people absolutely have the opiates, absolutely, within the first 24, 48 hours, because you want to address the pain. If you don't, then otherwise it can move toward chronic. But if it's used right, if it's prescribed in the right amount over a short period of time, it could be extremely helpful to prevent the migration toward chronic pain. Okay? It'll allow the body to come out of that bracing against pain and ease up. The problem comes in if you keep using it for too long. Okay? I didn't have that level of pain. So for me, initially, anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen, Tylenol, ice, I was doing my own hands-on work and easing it, softening the tissues, and I still am because it's still in a subacute state, was enough. But for some people, it's not quite enough. After several days, I could stop the ibuprofen and use just Tylenol, ice, arnica, movement. Little bits of movement because there's still a healing process going on for 4 to 6 weeks of the bone. But if I don't move, and if I stay in anxiety or sympathetic activation around the pain, what's going to happen? I'm going to brace against it. And if I brace against it long enough, it'll never come down. And then it'll keep going up. And it might go down and up, but it's going to not in a nice, even pattern to eventually settle out. Right. And I'm working with the emotions around it. I connected day two or day three of the agony the bone felt with the procedure, a necessary procedure, a necessary agony, right? But I can move through that and my jaw starts trembling, my body trembles, and I can discharge some of that out. And it's not done because I'm still in the subacute places. So it's really important to interrupt to prevent acute pain with physical injury in the proper way, and then interrupt the cycles and allow for the natural cycles to come back on board.
Now, when you say interrupt the cycles, like in your example of day two, yeah, or day three, where you could feel the agony and then a natural trembling, shaking, and release occurred.
Yeah.
When you say interrupt the cycles, can you be specific as to that example where you interrupted your cycle?
Yeah, very specific. So I was going for a short walk, because that's all I'm allowed right now, short walk. And I felt pain and I felt my body tighten up. Right. And if I maintained that tightening and kept walking a little bit, what am I doing? Now I'm walking on a brace, on a clench. And that's sending signaling up to the brain, something's wrong, tighten up more. Basically, something's wrong, go into a fight or flight mode. But I can't. I can't act on that. Okay. So instead what I did was that was an interesting feeling I just felt in my leg, interesting sensation. I did not like it. Okay, I still don't like it. In fact, I still don't like it. I'm going to sit down, right? I'm going to wiggle. I'm going to move purposefully around a little bit. And eventually the gripping eased up to where it was prior to the increase. Now, there's a natural amount of gripping happening in day two, day three, day four, day five, because it's not complete. There's still a physical healing process going on. But the important part of interrupting that cycle, I didn't really like that sensation. And I very purposely called it sensation, not pain. I didn't like that sensation. Soften my tongue. I did VU. You're familiar with VU from the training, this deep vibration sound down in the gut. That sends a more relaxing stimuli to the brain saying, you can ease up a little bit. So that interrupted the potential for it to get more reified, actually, into a dysregulated pattern.
I think it's so helpful for people to hear, because it's almost as if, or maybe not almost, it's as if to me, when we talk about chronic pain, whether it's from shock trauma, something physical that happened to the body, or emotional trauma that manifested. Because you said the brain can go to the organs, certain parts of the body create that tension, which creates the pain, or that part of the body can be hidden, it goes to the brain. So it goes back and forth. It's interesting with it, because For that pain to really heal, there has to be an expansion or an opening and some kind of mobility, even if it's really subtle, because you're saying like subtle wiggling. Yeah. And so I'm just wanting people to hear that the medicine, literally if you're on medicine, or the medicine, is to expand and soften that place where the pain is, so the body isn't feeling threatened by that location anymore.
In that way, the use of the word medicine is correct. If it's a medication medicine, that actually, depending on the medicine and it's called this mechanism of action, how it actually functions, may interrupt the actual sensory stimuli or the perception of the noxious stimuli into pain. So it may work differently. And with emotional pain, the very important interruption that has to happen as well. We have wired into us an immediate, implicit procedural response when we perceive something that is not right, that is alarming or threatening. And it's instantaneous. I walk into a room, nobody else looks like me, right? I orient, right? Do I feel safe, not safe? A very quick, non-conscious assessment that happens immediately. It's the reaction. The response, which is behavioral, which takes a few seconds at least to come on board, can also happen extremely quickly. And then we go into behaviors, we have an argument with a partner, or we perceive and we act as though people are dangerous because that's how we're reacting, not responding, right? So then we respond that way too. So we're not all, you know, completely present. If we can feel the reaction, the physiological reaction to someone yelling at us, to witnessing something horrific, to this, to that, and we can stretch the time out before we respond, behave, do something, we can stretch that time out, we can downregulate a little bit. If we can downregulate and tell ourselves, oh, I'm right here now. Yes, I really didn't like what was said to me. I really don't like seeing what I'm seeing happen in front of my eyes right now. But if I can feel that and give space, and I can feel that space in between response, then I can have choice. I can downregulate, I can soften, I can run, I can soften, I can speak, I can, if I have to fight, I can fight, right? I can walk away. Right. But I can do it in a way that might support a better relational dynamic than might otherwise be if I just respond as if it's instantaneous. But it's a second step, right? It's the same. It's similar with the physical pain, right? Oh, there was that implicit response, brace against it. Oh. Don't walk on the bracing. Pause. Slow down.
That's beautiful because that's how the perception and the unconscious perception of threat gets stored in the body and we're not even aware of it. And then, right. And then over time, even if it's emotional, let's say, like I'm saying, perceived threat, like you say, walk in the room. Nothing bad happened when you walked in the room, but there's a perception that something could. And so when the body tenses or reacts as if it's going to, I'm assuming we develop in that state of reaction and our gesticulations, our gestures, everything actually mirrors that internal unconscious belief. And from there, we can create, you know, physiological conditions like migraines and backaches and such like that as well.
And dysregulated relational dynamics. And you know, if it's one-on-one, it's one thing. It's 30 people and 80 people. It gets more complicated because you're then there. I don't know my math. I don't know what the formula is called, right? 30 times 80 times 29 times 70. I don't know what the numbers are. I have no idea. Hundreds, thousands of interwoven nervous systems and the system as well. So it gets more complicated. But this is where work like nonviolent communication, being in movement, the body work that I do, base work, in addition to SE, can really be helpful in helping us feel the response and act differently than we might otherwise.
And it's so timely right now because of everything we're learning about covert racism as a nation. You know, it's so, one of my favorite teachers on that is Rezma Menakem. And I just think of how that awareness of being somatically racist, like having a physical response you're not even aware of based on how you said earlier, genetics and things that your ancestors experienced that you don't even believe the same values, but the body has that response. Mm-hmm. You know, sexism, like there's so many different ways we could see how the bodies as a culture to react to the other bodies. And yeah. So I think the work is so important to heal.
Well, humans react to humans and it's through our physiology. It's through the physiology. I just want to correct, if I said nonverbal communication, I meant nonviolent communication.
You said nonviolent.
Okay, very good. There's some really wonderful research. I think it's been variations on the theme, many different research that says the immediacy, the innate implicit responses do we have, the physiological, neurophysiological responses we have to several things. One is to difference. When the smell is different, when the visual are different, when the color of the skin is different, when the shape is different, when the voice is different than what I expected, we respond immediately. Our reaction is immediate. That's the implicit nature of it, right? But the behavior, that is not. There is a transgenerational pattern and it's learned. And that's what can change. Right. Yeah, there's a an author that I was just introduced to, Valerie Kaur, K-A-U-R, and she writes about see no stranger. Can I see other as though I already know other? It's the same concept. Can I stretch time out a little bit, feel my response, and say, who's this human being? There's a question I've put out for years and years and years and years and years. One of the first, second, third, fourth, hundredth thing I ask myself with students, with clients, with people, who's this human being I'm with? Right? Can I see a human being as a person, not a stranger, someone I don't know, but someone as I may know them in 5 years from now, you know, without knowing their story, without knowing who they are, right? Human to human.
And you know, even though you're saying this, it's so practical and it's rooted in even studies, but it's so spiritual at the same time. It's like if you can just if the spiritual conscious self, whatever we want to call it, can recognize the animal body it's in and kind of understand the two and have an inner connection with itself, we can do this deeper work of seeing the other without that behavior. The implicit response happens, we're aware of it, and we interrupt the behavior. Is that correct?
That's right. That's
right. I think it's so beautiful.
Exactly.
I love that.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, I have time for one more question.
Sure.
Even though I have 100. And I'm trying to think which one to ask.
Well, so we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, I hope so. So I guess let me think a moment. I think the last thing I would ask is, what's the first step people can take to get really conscious of that implicit response? What's the first step?
Feel yourself sitting in the chair right now. Can you feel your body in the chair? What percentage of you is in the chair right now? Soften your tongue. And now notice what happens to the percentage of you that you're aware of sitting in the chair right now. There, you notice how that shifted it. And if we can, doing it is, it's not that hard. Remembering to do it is hard. You know, if I go into the grocery store, right, these days with masks on and this, and can I soften? Can I feel my feet? Can I decide which head of broccoli I want to buy? Not just pick one up, right? Oh, that person is about 4 feet from me. I think almost 6 feet, because that's what we have to do these days, right? But I'm going to have the intention of 4 feet, even though I'm physically 6 feet. Can I pay attention to me, to my physiology, to my body, and attune with, be with other?
Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you, David Berger, so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
For more information on Dave and his work, visit daveberger.net. That's Dave, D-A-V-E, Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R.net. On October 10th to October 13th, he's part of a 3-day masterclass with Dr. Peter Levine and Abby Blakesley on chronic pain and syndromes, working with the somatic side of trauma. Feel free to visit his website, daveberger.net, to see all of his offerings. So as always, before you go, take a breath. Feel your body. Notice your emotions. And take that awareness into your life. I want to thank you for sharing this space with me. For more information on my work or any events that I might be hosting, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. And you can find me on Instagram or Facebook at Holistic Life Navigation. Hello, everybody. It is the time of year to begin registering for one or two of my slow groups that begin in July. My slow groups are these special groups where I focus on one topic and we deeply unpack it over the course of 6 months. So these are highly nuanced, deep dive, advanced groups. These are excellent for those of you who have taken my 6-week course or who just want to focus on one particular topic through a somatic and trauma-informed lens. The two that are opening up in July, or will begin in July, are my embodied parenting group and my embodied nutrition group. The embodied parenting group is just like it sounds, learning how to parent from your body, learning how to ground yourself in your parenting so you're not parenting from a reactive, triggered place, but from a much more conscious place so you can actually find joy in your parenting instead of it being a total hellscape, like some of you have told me it is, and I've experienced it myself. The other group is an embodied nutrition group. This has been requested for years. For the past 4 years, after students complete my course, they say, "Can you please do a course on nutrition and make it longer than 6 weeks?" So finally, I can say, yes, you can, and I can, and I did. It is a 6-month unpacking of the intersection between trauma, nutrition, and somatics. How do we recover from stress and trauma via food? How do we relate to food as a being and not just some object on the plate? What's the biochemistry of food? Why is it not the best for my blood sugar to have toast, but lentils are just fine if they're both carbohydrates? All of this and more will be unpacked in this 6-month group. To register for these groups, please go to my website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click groups. Or you can click the link in the episode details below. Registration closes on June 1st. It is only open through May because we need the month of June to prepare everybody for July. I'm looking forward to this deep dive with you all. I'll see you there.